Hey, podcast listener, this is Steven, the host of Trace Evidence, a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and missing persons. Each week, I dig deep into the evidence, suspects, and theories revolving around the unsolved cases you think you know: Elisa Lamb, Aisha DeGree, Brandon Lawson, and the ones you've never heard: Lily Aramburo, Candace Hilt, Kanika Powell. If you're a true crime fan, haunted by unanswered questions, join me each Monday for a thorough examination of the victims, their stories, and the unknown perpetrators behind them. Trace Evidence is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, and all your favorite podcatchers. Visit trace-evidence.com for a full list of episodes, transcripts, and to subscribe today.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that may not be suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Though I always warn you about explicit language, I'd like to emphasize that again before I give you a quote from Perry March. During the investigation into Janet Levine March's disappearance, many friends, family, and even old college friends spoke with news outlets. One of these was an ex-girlfriend of Perry's from the University of Michigan. She said Perry March was a jealous and volatile man who once punched her in a fit of rage. Perry threatened to sue her for defamation over this interview, but never followed up. He did, however, go on record with the Nashville Scene saying, "She was a slut. I fucked her for a few months. Then she came back from vacation, told me she had the crabs, and I dumped her." The ex-girlfriend later said they had never even had sex. My point is, this is how Perry March talks about women, on the record, knowing this would be quoted and re-quoted, while he was under active investigation for his wife's disappearance. And though he initially spoke in loving terms about his missing wife, his tone would turn much more sarcastic and sinister as the years went by, and he and the Levines engaged in what can only be described as all-out war. He was no longer the beloved son-in-law. He was a stranger who refused to even let them see their own grandchildren. When I say that Perry March is an arrogant man, I guess I could be more specific. He is an arrogant, misogynistic, petty, and cruel man. Welcome to Episode 21, Janet Levine March, Part 2. Picking up where we left off from the last episode, Perry had already been setting up his different stories with Janet's friends and family. He tweaked the story as needed with different people. By calling her parents that night, he successfully sowed the seed that their daughter had walked out, despite what the Levines knew of their daughter's character. This is because he had always been close to her parents. He considered Carolyn a surrogate mother and talked to her all the time. He worked in his father-in-law's law firm. They trusted and loved their son-in-law, so they believed him. The next day, he told a series of similar stories to the housekeeper, the nanny, Janet's friends, and finally, Marissa Moody, the woman whose son had a playdate set up with Sammy for that day. And though Perry claims Janet left him a detailed list of what he was to do while she was gone, he was unaware of this playdate. Marissa had always felt somewhat snubbed by the Marches. They were not rude to her, they were just not personally friendly, though their children got on very well. As long as her son had fun with Sammy, she wasn't concerned. So when she didn't see Janet March that morning and Perry didn't bother to come out and greet her, she wasn't concerned, just irritated and miffed at their perceived snobbery. It wasn't until much later when Marissa was questioned and mentioned the rolled-up oriental rug that investigators realized she was a key witness. Because she saw the rug when she dropped her son off, but when she came back, she noticed it was gone. It was unusual for the decor of the Blackberry Road house, so it stuck in her head. But she did not see the significance until investigators questioned her, and horror struck at the thought of little Sammy bouncing up and down on his mother's corpse. But back to the timeline. After Marissa Moody picked up her son that afternoon, Perry came back to the house, picked up the children, and then drove them over to the Levines' home. Then he and Larry Levine drove to Nashville International Airport looking for Janet's Volvo. They didn't find it. But by Sunday night, August 17th, Carolyn was really starting to worry. She had never felt that Janet would leave her children for so long without telling anyone. But she had Perry and now his brother Ron wearing her down. They insisted everyone wait and respect the 12-day period that Janet's list for Perry had indicated before alerting authorities. That same night, Perry called his father Arthur, who had moved to Mexico. He was living in a caretaker's cottage on an estate on Lake Chapala in Jalisco, a popular place for retired Americans due to the low cost of living. Art told Perry he would come and help him with the kids and drove from Mexico to Nashville, arriving a few days later. And according to court documents filed by the Levines, on August 23rd, Perry March had hired a criminal defense attorney. This is an important date to note because it is the Friday of that week, the week she went missing. And by the end of the week, the Levines were beyond worried and ready to report Janet missing. Sammy's birthday party was scheduled for that Sunday, and of course, per Janet's note to Perry, she wouldn't be back until the 29th, the following Thursday. The Levines knew their daughter would never miss her son's birthday. Hell, everyone who knew Janet didn't believe that she would skip it. Perry says he insisted they go to the police while the Levines wanted to wait. He claimed that they didn't want to embarrass Janet if she had indeed gone on vacation. Of course, the Levines dispute this and say Perry was the one who wanted to wait. Either way, neither the Levines nor Perry March reported Janet missing until August 29th, the day she was supposed to have returned, if you believe Perry and the supposed list. But Sammy's birthday party went on as scheduled that Sunday, the 25th. The family told guests one of Perry's accounts that Janet was visiting her brother in California, but said that she'd gotten an ear infection and couldn't fly home in time. The guests all later said they accepted this account. Honestly, illness would have been the only reasonable explanation for Janet's absence. Curiously, Arthur March came to Sammy's birthday party, but left to go to Chicago the very next day. When Carolyn asked Perry why, she said he told her, quote, "Dad has a big mouth and tells everything," and then later shouted, "Fucking Janet has ruined my life." Carolyn was quite naturally shocked by this. She'd never heard Perry speak about her daughter like that before. So now she and Larry were even more suspicious. But as promised, they did wait until August 29th. That morning, they called Metro Nashville Police and reported Janet as missing. After speaking with the Levines, the detectives checked Janet's bank and credit cards for activity and found nothing. They also checked with all local hospitals and the airlines. By now, the brother that Perry had claimed Janet was visiting, Mark Levine, had flown in from California. He said that right after the Levines made their statement, a Metro police car came to their house. He said that Perry was there at the time and became so visibly nervous that he shook uncontrollably and had trouble rising from his chair. He then asked Mark to call his own brother, attorney Ron March. At some point during all this, the Levines got a look at the supposed list that Janet had left. They had many reasons to doubt that this was something Janet had written. First, it was typed out on a computer, and Janet never did that. She was a notorious list maker, as coincidentally was her husband. But she always handwrote out her lists. I am a list lover myself, and there is a certain satisfaction in handwriting it and marking off as you go. Maybe I'm projecting, but this part rings true for me. Also, Janet had very distinctive handwriting. Likely another reason she preferred to handwrite her lists. She wrote in all lowercase letters, very neatly, and it was distinctive because she really never capitalized, even proper names. If you've ever seen an artist's handwriting, this will ring true for you as well. Artists often have unique handwriting, so perfect that it looks like typeface. This is how Janet's handwriting is described. Incidentally, Perry capitalized everything. He wrote in all caps all the time. In the age of the internet, this is the equivalent of shouting the written word. I may be projecting again, but he does strike me as an all caps kind of guy. Carolyn Levine also pointed out that Janet typically dated her lists at the top of the page, like most of us do. While Perry, seemingly as unusual with his handwriting habits as his wife, always dated it at the bottom of the page. My thinking on this detail is that as a lawyer, Perry would have been in the habit of signing and dating many documents, typically at the bottom of a page. I could ramble on all day about the meaning of handwriting mannerisms, but instead we will take a look at the content of the note. It was titled, Perry's Turn for Janet's 12-Day Vacation, and the list was numbered. 23 reminders for Perry while she was gone. But first of all, and most importantly, it did not mention the playdate with Marissa Moody's son. Janet's family and anyone with children would guess that her first instruction would be her kid's schedule. As in, hey, don't forget, Marissa is bringing her son over for a playdate with Sammy tomorrow at 10 a.m. Even though Perry had at first said he was unaware of the playdate, after the list was scrutinized, he changed his story, insisting that he himself had arranged the playdate and just forgot. Obviously, Marissa Moody disputed this in court. The list was essentially reminders to feed the kids 3 nutritious meals a day, read to them, pay bills, call the driveway guy, clean out the garage, etc. The list was really just that simple, a to-do list. At the end was a sentence that read, I agree to do all of the above before Janet's vacation is over. Parentheses, in response to Perry's cowardly, rash, and confused vacation. Perry had signed below this list. Carolyn later testified that the night Janet disappeared, after she put the children to bed, she found a yellow legal pad next to the Marches' home computer, with a handwritten list of chores, very similar to those found on the typewritten list. At the top of the list, in Perry's distinct handwriting, were the words 2 weeks, and they were circled twice. If I'm guessing, Perry sat down and brainstormed a list that Janet might make and then realized his handwriting would be a dead giveaway, so he typed it up. If you're wondering why I'm spending so much time on the list, it's because it was heavily debated in court, because it would have been her last known communication. It looks like he is setting the scene for her leaving. I've said before, all good lies have a little bit of truth. Perry has never denied the couple argued that night. He just insists Janet left for a solitary vacation, but a vacation that would make her miss her son's birthday party. He needed to make it sound good. So the list sounds like punishment. It implies that he had run off before. Indeed, he had stayed in hotels, that is a proven fact, and I guess that's what he's going for here. That Janet was punishing him. Punishing him for leaving her alone with the kids and doing all the work. These would be the typical wife complaints. He even told the police she said, your turn, see ya, as she was leaving. When Janet's brother Mark arrived from California, he asked Perry to see the list. Perry said he didn't have the copy any longer, that he'd given it to the police. Mark asked if he could go see it on the computer, and Perry agreed, but asked to drive separately back to the house. Mark testified that Perry raced ahead of him, and when he got there, the door was locked. Perry finally came and let him in after he rang the bell several times. On cross-examination at Perry's trial, Mark Levine did concede that he saw the list and did note that it was timestamped at 8:17 p.m. on August 15th, the night Janet disappeared, and was consistent with Perry's story of the timeline. His official timeline had also matched up with the phone records. Perry had planned carefully, but he didn't plan for Janet's brother to keep snooping. Mark found another file on the computer, a document that was 6 pages long, single-spaced, with no indentation. It was a long, sprawling list of all the hurtful things Perry had ever done to Janet. I think this explains her short conversation with the nanny that day. As she went in the office and shut the door, she explained that she would be at the computer all day. She had obviously sat down and furiously poured her heart out. After Mark found this document, Perry looked nervous, but told him he was welcome to print it out if he wanted to. Mark tried, but he couldn't figure out how to print it from the Marches' computer, and Perry refused to explain. This was the beginning of the end to the friendliness with the Levines. He had already begun to lose their trust. But once the police were involved, everything changed. One more point about that list before we move on. If it indeed was written by Janet because she was going on vacation, then why did Perry need to make the phone calls that night? Why was he already raising the alarm that Janet had left? Was it possibly to also set up his alibi? Because if the list is not believed later, then he would have his concerned phone calls to back up his side of the story. Moving back to the timeline, the police finally caught their first break over a week later. On September 7th, Janet's Volvo was found at the Brixworth apartment complex, about 5 miles or 8 kilometers from the March home on Blackberry Road. The car was locked and backed into a parking spot. It was at the back of the complex, about 200 yards from the main road. Detective Tim Mason testified to what was found, which was essentially what Perry reported she took with her. They found Janet's purse with her wallet that included her driver's license, credit cards, passport, and $11 in cash. As Perry said, there was a small suitcase found with clothing and a toiletry bag. However, as pointed out in trial, the suitcase was missing some essential female items. Though clothes were packed, not one bra was, nor was there a toothbrush or hairbrush. No woman would forget to pack underwear, much less something as basic as a toothbrush, and she's damn sure not forgetting a hairbrush. But a man, rushing to pack a bag for a woman, might overlook these details. The bag was basically packed with sundresses, which would be fitting for a vacation, but little else. The detective said there was a layer of dust and pollen on the exterior, meaning it had been parked there for some time. There were even cobwebs in the wheel wells and rust on the brake rotors. The front passenger seat was pushed back, but the driver's seat was up close to the wheel, as if a short person had been driving. On the floor of the driver's seat, Janet's white sandals were found. One of the crime scene investigators later told reporters that the shoes looked carefully positioned, not as if they were kicked off by someone changing shoes. Finding the car was supposed to be a break, but so far it was a dead end. The Levines were now beyond worried, beyond terrified, and they were starting to get angry. They wanted answers. On the same day that Janet's car was found, they hired a private investigator named Kim Garbler, who later testified at Perry's trial. She said the first thing she noticed about Perry is that he referred to his wife in the past tense. She then decided to go canvass the Brixworth apartments for witnesses, which apparently the police had overlooked. And she found one. Peter Rodman was a flight attendant for an international airline, and his home base was B&A Airport in Nashville. As a flight attendant, he kept unusual hours. He testified that on August 16th at 1 a.m., he saw a man wearing a jogging suit slowly walking a bicycle in the apartment complex parking lot. This would be 4 or 5 hours after Perry said that Janet had walked out. Peter Rodman said that when he saw the man, he froze. He was standing about 10 feet away from him in a well-lit parking lot, and he identified Perry March as that man at trial. Also, prosecutors called the owner of a local bike shop. Perry March owned a mountain bike, and they wanted to show that it would have fit in Janet's Volvo. He testified to pictures of Perry on his bike and said that particular brand had a quick release mechanism on the front wheel that allowed you to remove it for storage. He also said that the bike was small enough to have fit in the Volvo's front seat. And if you remember, that seat was pushed way back when the police found the car. But back to the timeline, when Perry found out what the private investigator was doing, he became enraged. He called her and demanded that she fax him a list of everyone she had spoken to, what they had said, and then he slammed the phone down on her. Seeing as she was employed by the Levines, she didn't comply. Finally, 5 days later, Metro Police searched Perry's Jeep. I hate to criticize the police too much in this case, because I truly feel the investigation was hampered by Perry and the Levines' decision to wait to report Janet as missing. But it's difficult to point fingers at a grieving family. Obviously, I do understand it from their point of view. Perry had always been like their own son. They clearly did not suspect him at first, no matter how unusual they found his story. And they respected their daughter. This was an extremely close family. They were very involved in every aspect of their daughter's life, including her husband's career. In fact, it's possible Perry March wouldn't have had much of a career after the sexual harassment incident at his last job if Larry Levine hadn't hired him. He may have been able to stop the paralegal from suing, but that doesn't mean word doesn't fly around the legal community when something like this happens. But back to the Jeep. The same detective who searched Janet's Volvo searched Perry's Jeep. He recovered hair and fiber evidence from the back seat. At trial, a trace evidence expert testified that the hair was tested against hairs from Janet's hairbrush for DNA. Mitochondrial DNA analysis showed the hair found to be consistent with Janet's DNA profile. They also had a fiber expert from the FBI's trace unit testify at trial. The fibers found were multicolored trilobal carpet fibers. Karen Korsberg from the FBI stated that in her opinion, these fibers were definitely from a carpet and consistent with fiber you would find on an Oriental rug. As you remember, Marissa Moody saw an Oriental rug the day after Janet disappeared, rolled up near the kids' playroom, where Perry had refused to let the housekeeper clean. Also, the detective who searched the Jeep admitted under cross-examination that the Jeep did not appear to have been recently cleaned out. But on redirect, he insisted he smelled some sort of cleanser or disinfectant. Finally, on September 10th, Metro Police interviewed Perry March. This was 20 days after Janet disappeared and 12 days since she was reported missing. Come on, everyone knows the first suspect is always the husband. I'm unsure if this speaks to Perry's influence within the legal community, his wealth, or even the fact that he was a white man. Regardless, I find it unconscionable that they failed to interview him or search his vehicle and home until almost 2 weeks after she was reported missing. I will reiterate that I do think much evidence would have already been destroyed in the 12 days her family waited to report her disappearance, but that does not excuse the lapses after the police were made aware. During the police interview, Detective David Miller later testified that Perry was advised of his Miranda rights, which he waived, though he appeared to be very nervous. The detective was careful. He also advised Perry that he had the right to refuse to let the police search his home, but that they would get a warrant if necessary. At that, Perry turned back into regular, egotistical Perry and curtly replied that he was an attorney and was well aware of both his Miranda and Fourth Amendment rights. And he chose to write out a statement right then. In the statement, he downplayed the fight that night, insisting that Janet was frustrated and upset while he remained calm. He claims that he called and booked a local hotel room, something the police were unable to find evidence of, but that Janet had another plan. He said she went to the computer and typed up the now infamous list and then went upstairs to pack. He said then she came down with her bags, handed him the list, and as he told police, she said simply, "Your turn, see ya," and walked out the door. He's now embellishing on the story he told the Levines, always adding more detail. Detail that always paints Janet in a bad light. At this time, I'm going to pause for a word from our sponsors. On September 16th, the detective advised Perry's attorney that he intended to execute a search warrant for the March's home computer. Anyone who watches Law & Order is familiar with the scene where police officers show up with a search warrant. The Fourth Amendment guarantees the people's right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. It does not, however, guarantee the right to a heads-up to your attorney. Again, I am questioning all of these choices. Because on September 17th, when Detective Miller arrived at the March home, the hard drive to the March computer had been ripped out. A cursory search of the property turned up nothing. Now the digital evidence of Janet's official list, as well as the 6-page document her brother had seen, were lost forever. And now, the police were looking harder at Perry. They found that on August 21st, a week after Janet went missing, but 8 days before it was reported, Perry March bought new tires for his Jeep. The store owner later testified that he remembered it well because the existing tires were in excellent condition. But Perry had insisted on new ones, claiming he wanted a different brand. Why did he need new tires? What was he afraid the police would find? When police finally announced they were investigating the case as a homicide, and Perry was their suspect, the local media turned into a feeding frenzy, the likes of which had not been seen since Marcia Trimble's rape and murder 20 years earlier. Perry only made things worse in November when he didn't show up for Janet's memorial service. Even friends who were trying to remain neutral later said they were told discreetly that the Levines would prefer that they not visit while they sat Shiva for their daughter. This was the beginning of all-out war for the Levines and Perry March. Ultimately, Perry would lose all friends that believed in him, but you can hardly blame the Levines for wanting to ban any Perry sympathizers at this point. Meanwhile, the police brought helicopters, cadaver dogs, divers, and thermal imaging devices to search the woods near the March home for Janet's body. Not long after they searched his home, Perry March moved with his children to the Chicago area, in Wilmette, close to his brother, and he took almost all of his and Janet's possessions with him. It was later reported that all that was left in the house were Janet's clothes, hanging in her closet, and her bridal veil, hanging forlornly alone in an empty room. A friend of Perry's named Andrew Sachs later recalled that he helped Perry pack on September 18th, and he was very agitated. At one point, he screamed, "Fuck the Levines and fuck the Nashville police." Andrew Sachs was very put off by this. A man who is supposed to be worried for his missing wife should not be so angry with her family or the police for doing their job. He also noted that Perry never responded to his offer to help look for Janet in the days before the police started questioning him. His wife Diane was a longtime friend of Janet's and would later testify in court to some chilling remarks Perry made to her on the phone after he had moved to Chicago. They were chatting about the move, and Perry suddenly asked her if she believed he had killed Janet. She was stunned, and before she could answer, he said, "What if I told you I had put Janet's body in the back of her car and drove away while the children slept alone in the house, and then returned like nothing had ever happened?" Diane was very taken aback and stuttered finding a response, at which point Perry indicated that he was joking. But she didn't find it funny, and neither did her husband, who told Perry March not to call them anymore. And once Perry moved to Chicago, the scenario he gave to Diane was the one the Levines had already come to believe. And the couple's friends agreed, because as with Andrew Sachs, Perry never returned their calls offering help, and when he did talk to friends, he always behaved strangely, often inappropriately. In January of 1997, the Nashville Scene ran a two-part article on the case, giving details about the sexual harassment complaint at Perry's last job, and also even the rumors surrounding his mother's death. They even revealed the police theory on the case, that while arguing with Janet on the night of August 15th, Perry, a black belt in karate, had lost his temper and killed his wife. They theorize he hid her body in the woods until he got his hands on the rug, and then probably disposed of the rug in a dumpster they had yet to find. They also said that Perry's father Arthur and his brother Ron were also being considered as accomplices. Obviously, both denied any involvement. But it seems to have bit Metro on the ass to have leaked this information to the Nashville Scene, as the Scene portrayed them as bumbling Keystone cops. Quote, "Trained to handle drive-by shootings and domestic squabbles, Metro detectives seem to be embarrassingly out of their depth in attempting to gather information from the upscale segment of Nashville's close-knit Jewish community. And if Perry March, a fast-talking lawyer who was an honors program student at the University of Michigan and a member of the Vanderbilt Law Review, is involved in his wife's disappearance, he is proving to be more than a match for Metro detectives." End quote. Perry agreed to do an interview for the article as well from his home in Wilmette. He had the nerve to compare himself to Richard Jewell, the man who was wrongly suspected of the Centennial Olympic Park bombing at the Olympics that summer in Atlanta. It took authorities 3 months to clear Jewell, at which point his life was wrecked by the publicity. Perry actually said the words, "I'm the victim in all this," to the reporter he spoke with. Never mind his missing wife or motherless children. He also said he was working on financing to buy out Lawrence Levine's share of the Blackberry Road house, the home that Janet had so lovingly designed. He intended to move back there with his children and open his own law firm. Quote, "I will not allow one misguided police officer, one vengeful man, and a few low-life journalists to destroy what I've taken years to build." The scene pointed out that Perry wasn't exactly wrong in saying his life was being destroyed. The prominent Jewish community had completely ostracized Perry March, but I'm not sure that could all be blamed on Lawrence Levine. Though one anonymous friend said, quote, "When Larry is lucid, all he can talk about is destroying Perry." But you've got to remember, Perry was not making any effort to maintain his own relationships. His friends and the mutual friends he had with Janet all complained that he refused any and all help, and they were snubbed and turned away. Sure, you could say he was a man grieving in private. But men like that don't say the sort of things Perry did to the reporter from the Nashville Scene. This is the same article with a quote I opened this episode with. When the reporter asked him about his college ex-girlfriend who claimed he struck her, he spewed, "She was a slut. I fucked her for a few months. Then she came back from vacation, told me she had the crabs, and I dumped her." He then went on to say he planned to sue her for defamation, along with the editor of the Tennessean, for reporting on what he characterized as salacious rumors and innuendo. For the record, Perry never sued his ex or the Tennessean. He also threatened to sue his former employers at BB&S, now claiming that they are racist and anti-Semitic. Basically, Perry March was lashing out at everyone and anyone who disagreed with him. And really, the police did spill all the tea to the Nashville Scene. Even the theory that Janet had discovered the paralegal scandal and told Perry she would divorce him and cut him off financially. Of course, Perry said his attorney advised him against commenting on this part of the story due to the agreement made with the paralegal. And the Scene even had a source in the district attorney's office who criticized the homicide division for focusing so heavily on their only theory. However, their theory would later to be pretty on point. They just seemed to drag their feet with obvious investigative avenues, like questioning Perry's relatives that he'd called the night Janet disappeared. They never questioned them at all. They also never questioned the children. Then, of course, there was the delay in searching the March home or Perry's Jeep. Once they did search the home, they came in like gangbusters, with a backhoe to dig up the yard. Reportedly, Perry and his brother watched from the back deck while smoking cigars. This man was not worried they would find any evidence, because he knew nothing was there. In the interview, Perry said, "Without a shred of evidence, the police and my in-laws have taken away my house, my livelihood, and my community. They're trying to screw around with my son and daughter. I've been wrongly accused of sexually abusing my kids. My daughter has been subjected to a complete medical examination. But you'll see. I'll be vindicated." Both of Perry's children were evaluated by a child psychologist. But that was in 1999, after the Levines had filed a petition for visitation. The psychologist sided with the Levines and criticized Perry for having no photos or mementos of their mother for the children. Perry would, of course, say he was trying to protect them. But it should be obvious to anyone that you cannot erase a mother from a child's life like that. When he realized the psychologist was going to support the Levines' petition, she later testified that he became openly hostile towards her, threatening that he would disappear in Singapore and no one would ever see him or the children again. Clearly, he would later try to make good on this threat. He just chose Mexico instead of Singapore. In the meantime, he and his in-laws embarked on litigation that would go on for years. Unfortunately, Perry and Lawrence had that in common, that same litigious attitude and refusal to give up. In October, Perry filed a petition in probate court to have himself appointed administrator of Janet's assets. Naturally, the Levines opposed this, filing their own motion, first in Tennessee, then in Cook County, Illinois Family Court, for visitation rights as grandparents, which, of course, Perry fought vehemently. At the probate proceeding, the court quickly appointed a conservator to protect Janet's property, while Perry and the Levines battled it out in court. The judge warned both parties that if they could not work out some sort of settlement, Janet's liquid assets would soon be depleted, and the court would be forced to sell her personal property, property which would have sentimental value to her children one day. Of course, Perry had moved and taken almost everything with him. Even when the court finally ordered him to return some of Janet's things to her parents, he returned them in damaged condition, but mostly ignored the order anyway. He even once told them that he had stored everything in a town in Indiana, but when they showed up to collect what was there, there was nothing. They later said he did it solely to inconvenience them. As bitter as this war was getting, I believe it. Perry also refused to make depositions, which led to contempt citations. When the Levines filed their visitation petition after Perry moved the children to Chicago, his argument was that they only wanted to see the kids to let the police or media interview Sammy. He claims the kids were asleep when Janet left, so even if that was true, Sammy would have no memory of it. I understand wanting to shield your child, especially with the media, but keeping the children from their grandparents was cruel, and keeping Sammy from speaking to the police if he did see something is obstruction of justice. But as we find out, Perry found lots of ways to delay justice. When he finally agreed to be deposed in October, Perry invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination 15 times, including when asked if he killed his wife. Naturally, this made Nashville headlines and cemented the public's feelings towards him. In 1999, the court awarded visitation to the Levines. It had been 3 long years since their daughter's death and since they had been allowed to see their grandchildren. They arrived in Wilmette to pick up the kids, and Ron March, Perry's brother, who was also a lawyer, met them at the door and told them that Perry had moved with the kids to their father's place in Mexico. Arthur March later told CBS News that he only brought Perry and the kids to Mexico because they didn't have any other place to go. No, Perry moved to Mexico because the Levines won the right in court to see his kids, and he was determined that wouldn't happen. Within a week of moving to Mexico, Perry took up with a local woman named Carmen Rojas and married her a few weeks later. Their marriage was only possible because by then, the Levines had succeeded in having Janet declared legally dead. Because now, although the Levines were still fighting in Nashville to see their grandchildren, they had also amended their probate claim to include a wrongful death allegation against Perry March. In May of 1999, Perry's license to practice law had been suspended. Lawrence Levine's law firm had sued Perry on the grounds of fraud and embezzlement. Right before Janet went missing, Perry had asked one of his clients he managed to delay payment to the firm because he was planning on opening his own law office and wanted the client to pay him directly. He had indeed already rented office space to do this, but it would seem after he took Sammy and Zippy away from the Levines, the all-out warfare included investigating his time at his father-in-law's law firm. The Tennessee Supreme Court officially disbarred Perry March not long after, and Perry's legal troubles were only starting. In January of the year 2000, the Levines won a wrongful death judgment against Perry March, and the court ordered him to pay $113.5 million. Of course, he immediately appealed. And he had never even shown up for court. He stayed in Mexico, building a life with his new wife, Carmen. He gave an interview where he characterized his family as the Brady Bunch. He and Carmen both had children from their previous marriages, and now they had a son together as well. He spoke benignly of his missing wife, saying that she was a good mother. His use of past tense when speaking of Janet was lost on no one. In May of 2000, the Levines came to Ajijic, Mexico, where Perry was living with his new wife and kids. They demanded to see their grandchildren. The Tennessee court had finally ruled in their favor, and they came armed with the order. Perry and his father refused to let them see the kids, and Mexican authorities refused to follow the American order. But the Levines returned a month later. This time, they had a Mexican court order as well. The Mexican authorities also arrested Perry at this time for violating the terms of his visa. Though he was eventually able to get the charges dropped, while he was being detained, the Levines went to Sammy and Zippy's school and pulled them out. They raced to the airport, with Arthur March literally chasing them in his car. He was too late. They took the children back to Nashville. The visitation order gave them 39 days to spend with Sammy and Zippy, but as soon as they got back to Nashville, they began the process of trying to gain permanent custody. While the Levines believed they were acting in accordance with the laws of both countries, Perry declared they had abducted his children. Two Tennessee lawyers agreed with him and called him. They agreed to represent him pro bono. They went to federal court and under the International Child Abduction Remedies Act, sued to have the children returned to Perry in Mexico. Perry told CBS News that, quote, "The bottom line is, you can't steal children and try to make custody determinations in the jurisdiction where you stole them too." And I have to say, as much as I sympathize with the Levines, what they did feels wrong. It had to have been upsetting for Sammy and Zippy to be ripped away from their father, spirited off on a plane, as their grandfather literally chased after them. The Levines argued they had rightful custody of the kids once they were back in the United States because of the visitation order. They said the children's habitual residence was actually Illinois, not Mexico. They also argued that Perry could not bring the case due to the fact that he was a fugitive from justice at the time he left for Mexico due to the outstanding contempt charges from their earlier civil cases. A federal judge, Alita Troger, ruled in Perry March's favor. The evidentiary record, she said, established that the children's habitual residence was Mexico at the time. While the Levines believed Perry had killed their daughter and had won a civil judgment against him on those grounds, they never alleged that the children witnessed it and did not otherwise establish a reasonable possibility that they might be harmed in Perry's care. And while Perry did face outstanding contempt citations, that did not meet the criteria for barring his petition as a fugitive. She ordered the Levines to return the children to Perry once the 39 days expired. However, she stayed her decision so both parties could appeal to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. A 3-judge panel heard oral arguments in March of 2001. Mark Levine represented his parents. A month later, the panel unanimously upheld the district court. Judge Richard Sir Heinrich wrote that the original judge's opinion had been well-reasoned enough for the appeals court to adopt it in full. Most of his opinion was devoted to elaborating on this and rebuking the Levines. Perry could not have been a fugitive at the time he moved to Mexico, he wrote, since the contempt citations were issued after he went to live there. He noted that the contempt orders from the probate court stemmed from Perry's failure to return to the Levines a beaded evening bag and a baby blanket, which he called patently insignificant grounds for what he said was, quote, "the Levines' vindictive attempt to deprive March of his day in court." Judge Sir Heinrich also noted that the Levines had exceeded the authority of the Mexican court order, which only allowed them to take the children as far as Guadalajara, and that by taking them back to Nashville, the Levines and their son had incurred kidnapping charges in Mexico, for which there was an arrest warrant, though that warrant was later dismissed. In 2003, a Tennessee Court of Appeals judge, writing for the majority in the last decision on the custody case, called the custody battle between the Levines and Perry March, quote, 31 months of what can only be described as trench warfare. Even a dissenting judge agreed that, quote, "the acrimonious relation of the parties is resplendent in these proceedings." After the children were returned to him, Perry settled into his life in Mexico, working as a business and financial advisor and opening a cafe with his wife, in his wife's name, of course. Later, in 2003, he won another legal victory over the Levines when the Tennessee Court of Appeals overturned the wrongful death judgment against him. The 2-judge majority found that the Levines had offered no new evidence that Perry had killed Janet when they amended their claim to include wrongful death almost 3 years into the probate litigation, and that Perry's misbehavior did not warrant a default judgment against him in that case, especially since he had offered to be deposed either by telephone or in Mexico. The majority, however, did deny Perry his motion for dismissal of the wrongful death claim. But the tide was slowly turning for Perry March. As he had abandoned the house on Blackberry Road because he had no legal standing to it, Carolyn Levine personally searched the house. Perry had carefully packed almost all of the family's possessions when he moved to Chicago, with the exception of coldly leaving personal items of Janet's, her clothing, and, as it turns out, a box of paper she had stored in the garage. In the box, Carolyn had found two envelopes with Janet's name and her own handwriting on them. It was like she was leaving her own clue. Inside the envelopes were the original letters that Perry had sent to the paralegal at Bass, Berry & Sims back in 1991. Evidently, he'd kept the originals and sent the woman photocopies. Carolyn called the police. Perry's motive now seemed obvious. Janet had discovered these letters and confronted Perry, probably demanding a divorce that night. And Nashville police had not given up on this case. They were biding their time, collecting witnesses and evidence, and finally presented it all in secret grand jury proceedings. 59 witnesses testified. And finally, the state got their indictment against Perry March. An indictment that was kept secret as they worked with the FBI and Mexican officials to finally bring Perry March home to face his past. To finally get justice for Janet. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original theme music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. I hope you enjoyed the second part of my series on Janet Levine March. We still have one episode to go. I warned you in the first episode that this case was a doozy, and the twists just keep coming, even in the final act. As always, if you enjoyed this show, please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on Stitcher and many other apps. If you're interested in supporting the show, please come check out my Patreon page or my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, where you can make a one-time donation just by hitting the donate button. I also have a merchandise store open at whatamaneuver.net. Just search the show name and you'll find all kinds of fun options. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I'm also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform if you'd like to connect with me there. If you're interested in discussing the Janet March case or any episodes further, come check out my discussion group. It's linked to my main Facebook page. I would love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.